First of all, I want to give a yasher koach for the wonderful job the yeshiva does here. We've had over the years, almost every year, we have one or two representatives from Silver Spring here, this year the same, and do an extraordinary job of developing young Bnei Torah. We've had over the years many Baruch Hashem come to us, and we're always amazed by their integrity in Yiddishkeit, their emes in Yiddishkeit. Things are real, things are genuine, no, you know, corners are not cut, and very, very serious about the Yiddishkeit, and we appreciate it. So, yasher kochachem, and you should continue doing the job that you do. I guess before we start with questions and answers, let's ask ourselves, is there a place for questions and answers in the Torah? Everything has a source in the Torah, and a format, one would think that the right format for Yiddishkeit is, Moshe Rabbeinu comes down from the mountain, and like they say in Ivrit, Marbitz Torah, you know, whether you like it or not, thus has the Lord said, and that's it. You could ask, I didn't get what you said, but is there room for what we would call intellectual query or not? So I think there's a very important source, an extraordinary important source. Outside a minute. Moshe Rabbeinu has his first nevuah from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu appears to Moshe Rabbeinu. The place, so let's go through the conversation. Moshe was busy with the sheep. They were out to pasture. Vayinag esatzon acha midba vayovel harakim choreva. Vayera malach Hashem elav belabas eish mitoch asne vayar. Vehine asne boer ba'eish vasen ukol. He sees something very strange. He sees a fire that doesn't seem to consume whatever it is that its fuel is. Moshe said, you know what? I need to look at this. And why is it that the snare is not consumed? Hashem saw that he's going to. So let's think a minute. There was obviously a halacha that in that place, it's a makom kadosh. The place had a din of a makom kadosh. So Moshe Rabbeinu is being over an isser by standing there. Let's give an example. Imagine you saw somebody walked out of the tchum on Shabbos, or somebody was carrying something that's packing the airs down. So you wouldn't say, hi, Yankel, how are you? I've been seeing a long time. What's doing? By the way, the Erev's down and you're carrying something. The right thing to do is to go back immediately, not to throw it out in that place. Or whatever halacha is. You tell him right away. The first thing you say is it's usher, and then you get on with the conversation. Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu tell him Moshe Moshe Vayemehineni, and he says Al Tikrav Alon? So I once heard a vort from somebody named Reb Shamshon Fol Weiss. His son Reb Saul Meir Weiss is the son of Reb Chaim Shulevitz. He himself learned the Mir, was an extraordinary personality, a big time chacham. He was the executive director of OU for many years, extraordinary speaker and so on. And he once said, if Moshe would not have said Hineni, it would not have been a Makom Kadosh. And I want to add to that. Moshe's prophecy started with a question. He said, Asur leveres amar gadol hazeh, madua lo yevaseh. His interest was piqued. What's going on? Vayara Hashem kisor liros. HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw that he went out of his way to look at it, and then HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke to him. In other words, if you are an apathetic type of person, yeah, life is life. Why is this? Why is that? I don't know. I don't know. I don't care. It doesn't bother me. This is not, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't push his way into your world. Unless you stop a minute and ask a question, what's going on? Why is it going on? It's not going to happen. It's fascinating, Loshna Kodesh, the Ramchal in Sos Yeshorim says that a person, the first step in Yiddishkeit is that a person clarify to himself, what's my obligation in the world? The word ma in Hebrew means it's a question, and it also means like the word mahut. What is it? The word is both a true. It's a question. Understanding something is when you understand the issue and the problem. And that's why questions that really bother a person are going to get them someplace. The worst enemy of growth in Yiddishkeit, in anywhere, is couldn't care less. When something bothers a person, am I doing right? How am I supposed to respond to the situation? A person has evolved sometimes in a situation, it goes to somebody else. And he's bewildered. I don't know, the person did something wrong. The Torah says I'm not supposed to take revenge. Why? Why shouldn't I take revenge? It bothers me. He did wrong. Why shouldn't I? If it bothers you enough, you'll get to an understanding, and you know where to look, and you keep looking till you find an answer, you'll get someplace. So an honest question, and by honest question means that you're ready to commit to an answer that you've come to realize is true no matter how difficult the price, those are questions that really will get you someplace. So with that in mind, I guess just so we have a framework of where questions and answers have a makom, and it's questions that a person honestly is bothered by, something that a person will not rest until he hasn't clarified it for himself and found the truth. Those are the questions that are the beginning of Nevuah and the beginning of Moshe Rabbeinu's Nevuah. So I guess with that, yes?
So the Rambam has a principle that says God is not physical at all.
Yeah.
But doesn't that sort of limit God if he can't be something? And it kind of branches off into another one of Rambam's principles that says God is completely infinite. So then how can an infinite being create and live in a finite universe?
So let's get a piece clear over here. One of the problems we have with when we talk about infinite is that we start to stumble on the words because it really doesn't mean anything to us. We don't have anything infinite. So the word infinite in the sense that it's used is best translated, we can't put anything that would curtail HaKadosh Baruch Hu's activities. It's not what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is because we're clueless. So let's give an example. If I say that God's justice pervades the universe, so if this room is closed, can it get in? Can it just get in? Can it get out? The answer is that terminology doesn't apply to a concept. The only thing that we can, when we say God is infinite, we can't imagine him being all over the place, and therefore we can't put him in a box. All we can say is we cannot posit any limitation on God. And it leads to problems because we can't, honestly speaking, we can't work with that. The only thing is we know is we can't say, well, God didn't get there in time, or God didn't know about it, or God couldn't. That's the only thing it really means. Yes? Questions? Yes?
In terms of giving mice your money, let's say like you set aside, like you have a job, so every time you get your pay, you set aside money.
Right.
Let's say you're out on the streets, right, and
you're what on the streets?
You're like out on the streets, whatever. You're walking around New York City, whatever, and you wanted to give somebody tzedakah, but you don't have your miser money on you. So you take money out of your wallet and give it to them. Can you pay yourself back with the miser money?
If you have it in mind, one of the most important things to remember about miser money is there's a tricky rule that you can't pay off debts with miser money. So if you gave the money and then later you say, you know what? I gave the guy charity. Why should I pay myself for miser money? You can't do that. But if you say to yourself, I will give this money as my miser, miser money is not a physical entity. Like, this is tzedakah money. If I take out all the money here and I put in $100 or whatever it might be worth over here, that's just as good. So if when you're giving it, you're conscious of it, that'll be fine. So you say to yourself, I want to give this guy a dollar. My miser money is somewhere in the bank. So I am going to give this dollar to the miser account, and the miser account goes to me. That would be fine. Yes?
A lot of times when people ask a lot of questions, it leads to, denying God and not, atheism and stuff like that. So where's that fine line that one brings you, seeing Hashem, and one will not bring you to deny Hashem?
I think that there's a saying of one of the early Bali Musa, Reb Simcha Zissel from Kelm, once said that the mind is a stylus with which to inscribe on the heart. I would like to rephrase it a little bit in the sense that the mind, at the end of the day, is a tool. Rarely are our decisions... a lot of times there's a struggle between what we'd like to do and what our mind tells us. Most of the time, we end up tweaking the mind to have a sense of what we would like it to do. It's difficult. It's also... So if a person... If I really want to opt out of religion, I've had terrible experiences. Most of the time, it's got to do a lot more with your experience of it and your sense of it and the consequence of it than it has with dry mental calculations. You'll just keep asking questions. It's endless, kind of. I want to tell you over a fascinating story. There was one of the great Musar luminaries was somebody called Rabbi Yosef Yozel Horowitz. He was from the Vardik. I don't know how many of you read up about it and so on, but the Vardik was known for being very extreme in their Musar movement. It was a very powerful movement. It was in Europe. It was very powerful because they needed nothing and did everything. So they would come into a town, they would send two brachim in, they would come after Shachris, somebody would get up by the bima, give a klap, and say, we've just established the yeshiva Bebrisk. And, you know, anybody can register. And so one guy would run around town schlepping all the kids to sit them down in the shul. The other guy would beg for bread from the other people, and they had a yeshiva. So with that type of overhead, you could actually get yeshivas going. And they were very, very, very strident, and they accomplished a lot. The head of it, and his main shita was emes. And he was brilliant, very smart man. His grandchildren are alive. The Yafin family is one grandchild. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, his mother was a daughter of the Alta, a Navardic. Who else? Reb Soyanka Lachansky didn't leave any children. But the family still exists. The Yafin family is probably the most prominent family. And somebody once came to him, a professor from university. The person was not from... In those days, it was kind of... Everything was at a loggerhead. And if you were in university, you were very not from... and very liberal. And he comes in and he says, I heard that you're a very bright man and I'd like to discuss things with you. I've come to discuss religion with you. He said, great. He said, one ground rule. We will sit and talk. At the end of the discussion, if you're right, my yarmulke stays here, my talisman will stay here, and I go to university and I'm an atheist. If I'm right, you remain in yeshiva. So he said, nah, I didn't mean it to be so extreme. I just wanted to discuss it with you. So he told him, life is too short for idle discussions. I'm looking for truth. And I'm open-minded enough that I'm willing to accept it might be by you. But just to engage in a few days of hack, I'm not interested. It's very hard. When somebody's asking the questions, let's take a more contemporary example. When you have somebody, let's say, is dating somebody with the intention of possibly getting married. And then the person has a lot of issues. I think this might be wrong. This might be wrong. At some point, you get a sense, it's not the issues, but there's an anxiety about something or something else is going on that's churning out all these issues. When a person has one question, it's a question. When a person has 100 questions, you say to yourself, well, either it's so terribly wrong that there are 100 questions on it, Or the person's as an anxiety, an unwillingness, it's complex. Religion is not, it's not just philosophy. It means a big change in life. It means a big shift in who you are. And for most people, that's a lot of that causes. It's not questions per se as much as a sort of a process of expressing a desire to push it away. And that's tricky. A person has to be honest with himself and know himself and understand himself. Yes?
The Ramchal says in Das Nuras that the purpose of creation was that you can give over goodness to us. That only works through tzar and onesh and potential for mitzvah and avera.
Right.
So that's true. The Gemara Nida says that in Moshe Mashiach there's no mitzvahs. So
right.
Like, according to the Ramchal's premise, then what's the point of Moshe Mashiach?
Correct.
So,
can the question be repeated?
Yes, a little louder.
Can I say it again?
Yes, say it louder if you.
Okay. So according to the Ramchal says in Das Vunos that the whole purpose of creation was to give over, so God could give over his goodness to all of us, and he could only give over his goodness if we have an opportunity for mitzvahs and nazeres. But the Gemara just says that in Yemos Mashiach there's no more mitzvahs. So according to the Ramchal, there should be no purpose of Yemos Mashiach because there's no more opportunity for a mitzvah or nazer at that.
So let's give a mashal for it. We all understand what earning an honest dollar means, as opposed to stealing it, as opposed to getting it as a stucker, let's say, if you don't need to, as opposed to getting it just because you had somebody left you over a lot of money for no reason. So a person works hard and he earns money. If his money is now earning money, so I bought a building and I'm renting it out, I have the satisfaction the money coming in from the rent is still my money, because it was my sweat that bought the building, and any pay repairs, if I worked hard to plant a tree, and a tree is now there, and it keeps giving fruit, I see that as mine as well. The Ramchal's point is not that it's the overcoming of avaris alone, it's a condition that the schar that I get be for things that I earned. Once I earned it, and it's there, it becomes like principal accruing interest. The reason why I'm going to have Olam Haba in further on starts with the tree that I planted with my own sweat and worked very hard and let it down. So that's where that comes in. Yes?
For a student who imminently plans on entering the workforce, what do you consider as the most important thing for him to learn before, and also the most valuable thing for him to learn while he's in?
He asked for someone that's thinking very soon of going into the workforce, what's the most valuable thing to learn before, and what's the most valuable thing he can learn afterwards? I believe that's what you asked, yeah?
While he's working.
So first, a little plug for something, since I don't make money on it, we can plug it. I'm involved in an online journal, it's called Cloud Perspectives. Doesn't cost money, and it doesn't pay money, and it doesn't. It's nothing about its money. And we take an issue once in 3 months. You can go online, cloudperspectives.org, and every 3 months we take an issue that we feel is facing the cloud and solicit a dozen articles on it from people that we feel would have what to add and so on and so forth. The coming issue, probably at the end of the week or whatever, that's coming up now is dealing. In a different way, it's dealing with the transition from kollel to the outside world and how a person copes and deals with it. But more to your point, I'll first tell you over sort of a vertical of art, and then I'll try to give it some sort of a practical meaning. They say over from Yisrael Salanter, who founded the Musa movement, that someone asked him, he has a quarter of an hour a day, should he learn Musa or should he learn Halacha or Gemara? So he said, obviously he was the founder of the Musa movement, he said Musa, because if you learn a quarter of an hour Musa a day, you'll realize you have more time than that. Now, taking it back to something, I think the most important thing a person can do while he's in yeshiva, before he goes, is to establish, let's call it a control center, a piece of time. A person learns to learn Musa himself and to think about it. So a person gets to take a quarter of an hour a week. A half hour a week is a lot of time. People have a hard time today sitting alone and focusing inwards. We're so used to twitting, facing, I don't know all the different ways to do it, but the Memchas Dvarim that we can do to share it with everybody else, we're so used to it, we have a very hard time with it. As an exercise, to take a quarter of an hour a week that a person learns, A, he shuts out everything and everyone else out. He learns something that's over him, and he introspects and asks himself, where am I holding and what am I doing with my time? Where am I going to it? What do I think my biggest problems are? And where do I think I can push and get more time, better efficiency out of what I'm doing? So in my mind, that's the most valuable piece to be put in the place of a person's of a person's hekiv, of a person's activities. Because if you're in control of yourself, what happens is, with this week's parashas, Paro was very smart. He may not have been very nice, but he was a very smart person, because else the Torah wouldn't talk about him. The Torah doesn't talk about stupid Rishoyim, because there's nothing to learn from them. He's a smart... He said, I don't like the sound of Klal Yisrael murmuring. The thing that we need to do is keep them so busy that they don't have time to think. As long as they keep... And sure enough, when he died, all of a sudden people... There was a moment pause, and people said, hey, where are we holding? What are we doing? I remember I visited Russia when it was still under the Soviet regime. They used to send Americans and people with foreign passports, Israelis could not go, to teach. There were a few organizations involved in it, and I went once. And one of the sites that were amazing was, you had a city that was nominally a major metropolitan area, Moscow. The place where I stayed was in the center of town, was the nicest part of town. And besides the fact the stores had nothing to sell, every once in a while, there would be like a pushcar type thing would come, and it'd be this huge line of people around the block. And like one guy explained to me that as soon as they hear they're selling shirts, so everyone runs. I said, but you don't know if you like the color or the size, whatever. He says, it doesn't make a difference. Now I have a shirt, and I can barter it, and I can sell it, and I can do something with it. So they have this huge line of people, and people wait 2 hours to buy a shirt. And so it was written off, most people felt it was due to the great incompetence of the system, which is probably true. But somebody explained to me it's part of the system. People are so busy with taking care of the necessities of life, they don't have time to think about fomenting any revolution. They're so busy. If you're standing 2 hours for a shirt and another hour and a half for bread and butter and milk, so your time is usefully occupied with standing in line. No one has time to think about anything else. What happens to people is you get onto the wheel and you spin with it, and you're in the office until as late as the boss wants you. You come home, everybody's going to a wedding, you're going to a wedding, everybody's going golfing, you're going golfing. You never have time to be in control of yourself. So I think the most valuable, the shortage of it is to find time and discipline and to learn the skill of thinking about yourself and thinking about your life, and then at least be in control. Then you'll be able to make a decision. Until that point, once you get onto the wheel, you're going to spin and you're not going anywhere. Yes? Well, let's take somebody from the other side. Yeah.
So I have two questions. One, do you think of Maestroni on inherited money?
Yes, any money that came into your possession, you'd have to give Maestro money. Correct. Just like a gift or anything like that.
Isn't it like already in your possession, like it's in your parents'?
No. In some ways, I don't know if you've heard, in Lumdus, in certain ways, Yerusha is better than a Matana. For instance, a one-day-old baby can have a Yerusha. He can't ever get a present or anything like that. But if, to the best of my knowledge, for Maestro money, I think you would have to give... My son has to do with what came into you, what you gained. So wedding gifts, stuff like that, you would have to give my son money. I see you must be learning Hilchas my son money. I would have come done a campaign for the yeshiva or something. I would have...
yeah.
I see there's a... What?
Yeah,
you're learning Hilchas my sister?
No.
Okay. but the second person, I'm quite impressed. Yeah.
And secondly, to you... People consider like giving tuition money to like yeshivas. They consider that maaser money, is that true?
Okay, so that depends on two things. One, if the tuition consists of eating and sleeping, that you would have anyway had that expense. So the answer is no. So let's say at home it would cost $100 for the child. And in the dormitory, in yeshiva, it costs $200, so $100 he might be able to duck. There's another factor also, and this is more up in the air. It goes as follows: things that are considered normal obligations in that society. There is a halacha about to what point you have to teach a child, and anything after that you can give from Maisa. But if it's very normal in this society that it's considered almost obligatory, and and you would be told that you must send your kid to yeshiva, then it's not clear that you could take it from Isa. That's the rule is that which you're obliged to do, you can't take from Isa. That which you're not obliged to do, and it's a mitzvah, you can. So there would be a shikul hadas today. Let's say, I guess today, since it's, people go to yeshiva for a year or two after high school, I think it probably could be taken off. Probably. Yes. Let's take some new people. Okay. Yes.
Why are there no open miracles today?
Well, the real issue is, why were there open miracles once upon a time? If he said before, Ramchal, Hashem wants us to earn it on our own, an open miracle tends to defy that. Because it's something that is almost so evident that it doesn't leave you all that much room with free will. So it would be counterproductive to have open miracles. That's one. Two, let's give an example. When people are dating and they're on the way towards getting married, there is a lot of declaration of how much you care for the person and how loyal and so on and so forth. And you give gifts and things like that. You make a show of it because you're trying to establish a relationship. When you're married, you base it on all of that, and you don't want life to be constant. It's not a dating process. It's a process of living life. HaKadosh Baruch Hu established a certain emes with the different miracles that he did and certain yesodos of Amuna. Then we continue on faith and on trust and loyalty, and those are the important pieces. But you have two things. One, it would basically defeat the purpose of it, and two, it's meant to bring out loyalty. The fact that you base a marriage not on the fact that there's a continuous massive display of showing how much affection, it's there, and it's based on a tkufa that was very, very solid, and then it's based on the loyalty and the faith that just keeps going. Yes. Yeah.
It says in the Torah to listen to your rabbis, which is like the origin for mitzvahs derabanan. So my question is that when you do a mitzvah derabanan, do you gain merit for the mitzvah deraisa of listening to rabbis, or do you gain merit based on the individual mitzvah derabanan that you're doing?
So this was an interesting question. It was asked in the opposite. If you transgress a derabanan, did you transgress a deraisa because the Torah said to listen to rabbanan or not? That's the way. And then Marik says the following point. He says, it depends why you transgressed it. If you transgressed it because you were too lazy to light Hanukkah light, it was too far away, and you just weren't in the mood, so that's an aver rabbanan. If you don't like Hanukkah light because who are the rabbis that tell me what to do, then you're over the raisa. But I would like to add another dimension. So when a person does the mitzvah, he's both things are happening. He's being the kind of the rabbanan of the Hanukkah, and he's also affirming his faith and trust in Chachamim, as the Torah said. But I want to add another dimension to Rabbanans, because it's something that we struggle with a lot of times, that the Maral says. He bases it on a Gemara. The Gemara, Mishnah, it says, Vizkadashtem is Mayim Rishonim, V'yisem Kdoshim is Mayim Achronim. So he asks, what kind of limud is that? I mean, the pasuk Mayim Rishonim and Mayim Achronim are the Rabbanan by all counts. Why? What's the meaning of giving a pasuk? So the Maral says a fascinating insight, and it helps really give us a whole different take on Rabbanans. He says like this: the Torah itself includes obligations, and it includes understandings that are not obligatory. In other words, when the Torah said "Vizkadashtem," the Torah meant there is room to be kadosh, and that included mayim rishonim and mayim achronim. The Torah did not obligate you to keep them. So it's important to bear in mind the obligation is the Rabbanan. The idea that this is good for you in a spiritual way is a Doraisa. The Rabbanan had this sensitivity to understand in the Torah. It's just like when somebody, you have parents or teachers, they tell you to do certain things, but they also let you understand that certain things are good to do. They haven't told you that you must do it, but you're wise in understanding that it's an appropriate thing to do. That's how Maral explains older abundance. The Torah, they were sensitive and understood what the Torah feels is appropriate to do, even the things that are obligatory, and they decided which things to obligate us with. Yes?
Obviously, women don't have an Isser of Bittul Torah because they don't have a fee to learn Torah.
Right.
But do they have an Isser of Bittul Zman?
I wouldn't want to use the word Isser. I like to keep away from the word Isser. It's kind of a... But I would think that anyone who's a religious person and feels that his life was the most valuable thing given to him to do something with it would be abhorred by the sense of wasting time. Famous story, I don't know who to say it about. A famous Rav in a town walked in and he saw his Balabatim playing cards. And they kind of looked a little bit sheepish and they said, Rebbe, we're just killing some time. He said, you know, I've been at the bedside of a very sick person and doctors are desperately trying to save him, to give him another hour of life, another day of life. Why would you take with your hands and kill time? I was not speaking, I had a doctor, a neighbor of mine. He was an Israeli, a very firm person, a wonderful doctor. He passed away 2 years ago, young, prematurely. He was in his 60s. His name was Dr. Yossi Kleiman. I don't know if any of you have heard of him. He was Rabbi Asher's doctor. He was a very special person. He was a neighbor of mine, and we were very good friends. And we were schmoozing about, you know, different professions. And I told him, Yossi, let me tell you the difference in our professions. I said, you are in a hospital, and you're watching a 40-year-old man die. And you say to yourself, what a tragedy. Imagine if he would have lived another 40 years, what he could accomplish. And you're right, it's a tremendous tragedy, and your job is to prevent those tragedies and so on and so forth. He said, let me tell you where my job comes in. I said, I watch an 80-year-old man dying. And I say to myself, he could have given back 40 years change and nobody would have noticed the difference. Nothing much happened and you could easily squish out 40 years of his life and compact it. That's a much worse tragedy because